Thank you very much. Father Thomas, it's a great privilege to be here to share in this very important colloquium. My talk is arguing for a hermeneutic of continuity, to use the term that Benedict XVI made famous, in reading Dignitatis Humanae in conjunction with previous statements of the Magisterium having to do with the treatment of non-Catholics in civil society. First of all, a couple of general hermeneutic considerations. First, I think it's very important to insist that the burden of proof definitely lies with someone who wants to claim there is a real contradiction between the teaching of Vatican II and traditional doctrine. That's because the whole 2,000-year history of the Magisterium is based on the assumption that it's a function of preserving and guarding the deposit of faith that's been revealed by our Lord in the time of the Apostles, and that it's not part of the charism of the Pope or the Magisterium to invent new doctrines. And therefore, there's a very strong assumption that any formal document of the Magisterium, a strong presupposition that there will be continuity between what the Church says today and what she taught yesterday. And even if we're dealing with a teaching which is not proposed infallibly, and I would maintain that Dignitatis Humanae is not proposed with the appealing to the charism of infallibility. But even so, there's a very, very strong presumption that it will be in harmony with the previous teaching of the Church, or that if there is an ambiguity there, if there is an obscurity that's not clear, then the correct way to resolve that ambiguity is to understand the document in the light of tradition and not contrary to tradition. So, having said that, first of all, did the fathers of Vatican II themselves have any intention of not merely developing, which of course has always been understood since the time of John Henry Newman as harmonious, organic change, yes, but not contradiction. Did they intend to contradict the previous teaching of the Church? The relator, Bishop Emil de Schmidt, repeatedly told the fathers that the schema that is being promoted is not contradicting traditional doctrine. He gave his own explanation for that, and that's possibly open to debate, but the main point at this stage is that he certainly insisted to the fathers that this schema that we're being asked to vote for is in harmony with tradition, not contrary to it. And then in paragraph 1, the preamble, one of the final amendments, made the point that the council in this matter, as in others, appealing to the gospel passage, brings forth its storeroom old things and new, but with the new always in harmony with the Church's sacred doctrine and tradition. So right from the start, we have a clear statement within the document itself that the fathers intend this declaration to be understood in harmony with the great tradition of the Church. Also, in the preamble, Article 1 of the Declaration, the religious freedom affirmed by the document says that it leaves intact, that's integram, whole and entire, the traditional, and I quote here, the traditional Catholic doctrine concerning the moral duty of individuals and societies toward the true religion and the one Church of Christ. Now, the words traditional and societies, ac societatum, were added to the final draft by direct command of Paul VI. Remember that Vatican II was due to end on December the 8th. They had to get this document finalised before the end of the council, and that meant it was kind of a rush job. But in any case, the Pope insisted right at the very end that certain amendments be put in then. And 25 years after the council ended, it was finally made known that he was the one who personally, word for word, dictated certain last aspects of the final relatio, as well as some of these last-minute amendments. So the Pope was directly involved, and he said in a note to the Cardinal Secretary, of whoever it was, of the drafting commission, that these final retouches are to reassure those fathers who claim that there is discontinuity between the document as it stands and the tradition of the Church. When I did a licentiate thesis at the Angelicum almost 30 years ago now, this was not yet known. In fact, I noticed myself when I was looking at the Acta of the Council, hey, this is a very strong traditional statement right at the end in the final relatio. It didn't quite sound like the more liberal-leaning statements that Bishop de Smet had been giving to the fathers, leaning in that more liberal direction. And then I found out several years later, when I visited the archivist of Vatican II, and I saw some of the actual documents, that this had been personally dictated by Paul VI. That's why there was a difference in style there for that passage. But I'll tell you what, as well as the words traditional and societies being included in the final draft, I'll read out to you some of the words that were dictated by Paul VI, not for the document itself, but for the final relatio. The relator told the fathers that these amendments to Article 1, putting in the word traditional and saying that the duty not just of individuals but of societies as well was to be understood as upheld in this document. The relator said that these additions to the text were meant to express more clearly the doctrinal coherence of the declaration they were being asked to approve with, and I quote, ecclesiastical documents up till the time of the Supreme Pontiff Leo XIII, end of quote, and especially the insistence, quote unquote, of these documents, encyclicals of Pius IX and Leo XIII, their insistence on, and here I quote again, the moral duty of public authority, that's potestas publica, toward the true religion, end of quote. As a result, the final relatio said, quote, it is manifest that this part of the doctrine has not been overlooked. In other words, the final amendments, including the words that societies as well as individuals have a duty to the true religion and the one Church of Christ, this is being said to be upheld integrally. The intention of the document is to keep that without diminishing it in any way. And so in the light of this, in the light of the preamble, Article 1 to the Declaration, it's very clear, first of all, that the Council Fathers not only did not have the intention of contradicting previous doctrine, they had the intention of not contradicting traditional doctrine. And hence I would argue any interpretation of Dignitatis Humanae that places it in contradiction with the doctrine of previous popes cannot, according to the mind of the Church, express the declaration's true meaning. Well, that's by way of preamble. Now we need to think about how to justify this claim that there is not a contradiction. First of all, I think there's certain important distinctions need to be kept in mind. First of all, the distinction between what's proposed as church doctrine in the ethical sphere, that will mean teachings which are proposed as true for all times and places, to distinguish between that on the one hand and on the other, church public law or ecclesiastical or prudential policy judgments, which of course can be adapted according to different historical and cultural circumstances. I think that this distinction is not always sufficiently kept in mind by those who claim there is a rupture or a contradiction. Very often, most of the arguments that I've seen argue that there is a real contradiction between Dignitatis Humanae and previous statements tend to interpret every affirmation of Dignitatis Humanae as though it were being proposed as doctrine, as something true for all times and places. Now, I think that's something that would have to be proved, can't simply be assumed. And particularly when we consider the very nature of what kind of a document is Dignitatis Humanae, I think this is even emphasized, the distinction between what's doctrine and what is proposed as being policy or maybe a new norm of ecclesiastical public law, which is judged to be suitable for contemporary needs, that distinction needs to be kept in mind even more clearly in the light of the fact that, as His Eminence mentioned in his own talk, Dignitatis Humanae is a declaration. Too often, in critiques I've seen of Dignitatis Humanae, the critique tends to act on the assumption that there's really no distinction in the, or not an important distinction in the different categories of document of Vatican II, documents of Vatican II. But there is an important difference, and this is officially recognised. If you look in the Index to Apostolici Sedis in 1966, or during the years of the Council, you'll find there's a pecking order, so to speak. In the Index, constitutions are at the top, above all dogmatic constitutions, Dei Verbum and Lumen Gentium. Decrees are in the second category, and declarations at the bottom of the list. They are the least authoritative type of Vatican of statement from Vatican II. And there are three declarations issued by the Council. The other two are Nostra Aetate on interreligious dialogue and Gravissima Educationis on Catholic education. And you can see there's a similarity in the structure of all these three declarations. They all begin with a brief statement of some doctrinal principles, but then they go on to include judgments about how to apply those principles, or how the Church wants to apply them, or what aspects she wants to emphasize in our own day according to contemporary needs. So a declaration by its very nature is the kind of conciliar document that is specially emphasizing what's true today, how to apply doctrinal principles for contemporary needs. And so, like in the one on education, you get a very general principle that everyone was entitled to receive an appropriate education. Well, of course, that's something pretty elemental and basic. But what counts as an appropriate education is obviously going to differ a great deal according to historical and cultural circumstances. Same with Nostra Aetate. It begins with certain doctrinal principles that the Christian religion, as taught by the Catholic Church, has the fullness of revelation. But there are rays of truth in the different non-Christian religions, and the Church wants to emphasize in our own time the importance of dialogue, while at the same time, of course, it's a big missionary decree on ad gentes, on evangelization, missionary work, those two things, perhaps sometimes rather in a rather uneasy equilibrium, dialogue and evangelization. The Council wants to uphold both of them. So that's the first distinction we need to keep in mind, that not everything in Dignitatis Humanae should be understood as being proposed as universally true for all times and places. The structure of the document shows that the first, after the preamble, you have Articles 2 and 3, in which certain basic doctrinal principles are enunciated, and then most of the rest of the document has to do with concrete applications of these principles under modern circumstances, and that needs to be kept in mind. Another distinction to be kept in mind is the distinction between affirming, let's talk about activity X, whatever it might be, a difference between affirming a right to do X on the one hand, and on the other, affirming a right to immunity from human coercion in doing X. Now, this is an important distinction that is not always respected or not recognized enough, particularly among those who claim there is a contradiction. It's a crucial distinction. Again, difference between affirming a right to do X and affirming a right to immunity from human coercion in carrying out that same activity X. Dignitatis Humani carefully specifies that what it affirms as the natural right to religious freedom is only the second kind of right. It's a right to the object of the right is specified as immunity from human coercion and not the propagation or even belief in any particular given body of religious or philosophical belief. A theological affirmation that there is a human right to do X simply means that X in itself is a kind of action which is objectively morally upright and justifiable. But to affirm a right to immunity from human coercion in doing X, that is a right not to be prevented by human authority from doing X, does not necessarily imply that X is objectively good behaviour. It's simply a reflection of the important distinction between sin and crime. That is, it recognises the limited jurisdiction of government when it comes to penalising the errant behaviour of citizens. St. Thomas recognised long ago that it's not the function of human law or civil authority to outlaw and punish any and every kind of sin. That's Prima Secundae, question 96, article 2, if anyone wants to jot these things down. And he also answered negatively, St. Thomas, the question as to whether Muslim or Jewish parents could justly be prevented by Catholic governments from teaching their children their respective non-Christian religions. He says, no, you can't step in and, you know, take their children away from them and baptise them against the wishes of the parents, bring them up Catholic. That's Segunda Secunda, question 10, article 12. Does that mean St. Thomas is saying or implying that there exists a right to teach one's children false doctrine? Doctrine contrary to revealed truth such as the incarnation of the Trinity? Of course not, not at all. But he does say there is a right not to be prevented by government from doing so, because he understands the rights of a father over his family take precedence in that case. Other clear examples would be our Lord's own warning to avaricious souls who lay out their treasure on earth instead of in heaven, and to those who sin by neglecting the poor, sin of omission by neglecting the poor. These sins, of course, can be mortal. They lead to eternal punishment. Great parable of the sheep and goats in Matthew 25, for instance, and the rich fool whose soul is required of him that night. So yes, they're mortal sin, but does that mean Jesus was implying that government can justly punish a man for his thought crime of being inwardly too attached to the things of the world? Or that it would be just to send us to jail, not only for failing to pay our taxes to the government, but also for failing to donate enough of our income to charitable causes? Not at all. There's no insinuation in the Gospels that it's the role of government to intervene in that kind of matter. Extending to government the authority to punish every kind of sin, even every kind of grave sin, would in practice be a recipe for totalitarian tyranny. So coercion can be unjust and thus violate another person's rights, not only when it's inflicted on the innocent, but also when it's inflicted on a wrongdoer by someone who oversteps his own authority by inflicting it. So that's the second distinction to keep in mind. Another distinction, we need to avoid the fallacy of assuming that if we say a government should tolerate a certain activity, we are thereby implying or presupposing that it also has a right in justice to repress that same activity if it wishes to do so. For saying that a ruler tolerates activity X simply means that while disapproving of X, he decides not to repress it, even though he disposes of enough physical force, police or military or whatever, perhaps legal permission to do so. But whether or not he would have a true right, that is the moral authority, to repress X is a distinct question. In some cases he would, in other cases he wouldn't. So I think those who see a rupture in Vatican II are setting up a false dichotomy when, as many of them do, they claim to discern an implicit contradiction between Dignitatis Humani's language of rights in civil society for those practicing various different religions and the traditional papal language that spoke of mere civil tolerance for non-Catholic religious activity. The previous distinction I made before about the right to do X and the right not to be prevented from doing X also needs to be kept in mind here. But it follows from all this that the respective concepts of having a right not to be prevented by the state from carrying out religious activity X, that's the language of Dignitatis Humanae, and the language of being tolerated by the state in carrying out X, that's the language of the preconciliar magisterium, these are not at all logically incompatible. Now, keeping in mind the above, these interpretive criteria and distinctions, we can now set out briefly a case for non-contradiction, keeping in mind what I've been saying up till now. Not everything about Dignitatis Humanae, of course, troubles those who see a contradiction there. There is the part about not being forced to embrace the Catholic religion. That's always been explicit, of course, in Catholic teaching. What troubles those traditionalists, well, not just traditionalists, those who do see a contradiction between Dignitatis Humanae and the previous doctrine, what they have particularly in mind is the Declaration's assertion in Article 2 that within due limits, quote-unquote, no one may be prevented from acting publicly in accord with their conscience in religious matters. This assertion, many claim, is simply irreconcilable with previous papal teaching, notwithstanding the proviso within due limits, quote-unquote. Now, taking into account the elaboration of those due limits, which we find in Article 7 of the Declaration, we can synthesize Article 2 and Article 7 to formulate the proposition which we can say is really the most controverted proposition of Dignitatis Humanae, keeping in mind this question of whether it contradicts traditional doctrine or not. Now, you can see on the blackboard here, two propositions. I call them P and P1. Now, P is a synthesis of Dignitatis Humanae 2 and 7, zeroing in on the part that's really the main controverted part of the Declaration. It is unjust, the Declaration teaches, for human authority, whether Catholic or non-Catholic, to prevent people from publicly acting in accord with their conscience in religious matters, unless such action violates legal norms based on the objective moral order, this is into Article 7 now, that are necessary for safeguarding three socially valuable conditions. First, the rights of all citizens, A. B, public peace, and C, public morality. These three important social values, let's call them, are said to make up collectively the basic component of the common good, otherwise termed a just public order. It's important to note that according to the Las Prelaciones, the expression public order, which is used as the limiting factor in most of the document, is carefully defined in Article 7 as consisting of these three social benefits or values that are labelled A, B and C in the proposition on the blackboard. So that's why in the proposition I haven't used the word public order, I've just enumerated the three different components that declaration that Article 7 says make up the just public order. Now, it's a complex proposition, as you can see. There would be lots of different ways, from a point of view of pure logic, that it could be contradicted. But if it contradicts, if P contradicts traditional doctrine in the way which interests us in this debate, in this discussion, in other words, in the way that some would say allows too much civil freedom in religious matters in comparison to traditional doctrine, then logically the pertinent traditional doctrine, in order to contradict P, would have to be P1. And P1 reads, it is sometimes just for human authority, Catholic or non-Catholic, same authorities mentioned above, sometimes just for that authority to prevent people from publicly acting in accordance with their conscience in religious matters, even when such activity does not violate any of the three general norms A, B and C specified in P above. But in fact, I would maintain P1 was not in fact the Church's traditional doctrine. It can't be found in those words or in others implying the same thing in the Preconciliar Magisterium, ordinary or extraordinary. Because the popes of earlier times, who sometimes exhorted Catholic rulers to repress all public manifestations of non-Catholic religions, would certainly have answered affirmatively had they been asked whether such manifestations violated one or more of the three norms set out in Proposition P. We'll come back to that in the last part of my paper. Are we going for time? 20 to 12. Now, it might be objected, however, that P, above, conflicts with the traditional doctrinal maxim, error has no rights. I don't think that's true. That maxim is, of course, a figure of speech, but clearly only persons, not ideas in abstraction, can really possess rights. What that traditional maxim really means is that error can never be either the object of any human right, that is, that which the right entitles us to, or that to which the right entitles us, can't be the object of any human right. Nor can it be the foundation of any human right, that is, its reason, its grounding, its justification. But Dignitatis Humanis is nothing contrary to that. In fact, I could add here that in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, which in some ways can be seen as like an authentic commentary or interpretation of Dignitatis Humanae, I think it's Article 2108 specifies very clearly, religious freedom does not mean a so-called right to error. So Dignitatis Humanae does not say error has rights. It simply emphasizes that government should only exercise a carefully limited role in restricting the religious practice of citizens. It teaches that the object of the natural right to religious freedom is precisely immunity from coercion by government or other human powers, and not the belief in or propagation of the doctrinal content of this or that religion. At one point that was spelled out by the relator, Bishop de Smet. He said that the document in no way says, nor could it be claimed truly, that there is any such thing as a right to propagate a false religion. He's saying the declaration does not mean that, it does not imply that. But being a right to immunity from coercion under some circumstances of doing that, that's something very different. Yes, that's 2109, the Catechism of the Catholic Church. It says, the right to religious liberty is neither a moral license to adhere to error, nor a supposed right to error. However, those who claim discontinuity may still object that in any case the pre-Vatican Church often allowed, indeed exhorted, governments to repress all public religious activity except that of the true religion, Catholicism, and that this has now been disallowed by Dignitatis Humanae. Now, such legal restrictions did indeed obtain in such nations as Spain and Colombia right up until Vatican II. In other words, the traditional ethical line between legally permissible and legally repressible religious activity in public was the line between truth and error, not the three limiting criteria specified by Vatican II in Proposition P, which prescind from the whole truth versus error question. So is this a real contradiction? I would say no. To prescind from a former doctrinal position or to avoid restating it does not mean contradicting it. In any case, traditional doctrine left it an open question as to whether that line between truth and error should always and everywhere be the ethical line between legally permissible and legally repressible public religious activity. In fact, the Preconciliar Magisterium was practically silent about where that line should be drawn by non-Catholic governments. And since Vatican II very much wanted to address that issue, it unavoidably found itself in the position of having to break some new doctrinal ground in keeping with Vatican II's aim of reaching out to all humanity. So this declaration was directed to the rulers of all nations, not just to those with Catholic governments and or Catholic majorities. I'd say the key to appreciating this non-contradiction lies in taking note of certain nuances which soften the edges, as it were, both of the traditional doctrine and the doctrine of Vatican II, thereby enabling their reconciliation. This means taking note of what they abstain from saying as well as what they actually say. First, the traditional doctrine was never so rigorous as to affirm, though neither did it deny, that in all countries and at all times, that's from Pentecost right till Judgment Day, it would be within the bounds of justice for civil authority, whether in predominantly Catholic or non-Catholic societies, to suppress all public non-Catholic religious manifestations. Those who have never been members of the church, we charitably presume, are in most cases probably not violating their own consciences by continuing as non-Catholics. Now, some theologians, notably particularly Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre was very strong on this, have held that such suppression would never under any circumstances be unjust, and that at worst it would sometimes be imprudent or uncharitable. But that unqualified assertion of the universal justice of such repression never reached the status of church doctrine, either of the ordinary or extraordinary magisterium. Indeed, other approved traditional theologians, for instance, Suarez, Emmanuel von Ketteler, even going right back to Pope Gregory the Great, foreshadowed Vatican II to some extent. I don't say they taught exactly the same doctrine, but they certainly said things that were leading in that direction, we could say. They foreshadowed it by saying or implying clearly that under some circumstances, Catholic civil authorities are obliged by the requirements of justice not merely of prudence, to tolerate the worship of at least unbaptized monotheists, mainly Jews and Muslims, carried out in their synagogues, mosques, or other places of public worship. Once again, we need to recall that penalizing someone can be unjust under two titles: A, when he's innocent, or when the penalty is disproportionate to his offense, or B, when he is guilty and deserves the imposed penalty, but it's being imposed by someone who has no authority to impose it. For instance, if I succeed in overpowering a burglar who's broken into my house, and if I manage to keep him imprisoned in my basement for 3 years, I'm doing him an injustice. He may well deserve 4 years or 5 years imprisonment, but I, as a private citizen, have no right to decide on and administer any such penalty. That is, the burglar, guilty though he is, has a right to immunity from coercion by me. So I'm saying the traditional doctrine was not so absolute that it ruled out clearly the possibility that in some circumstances there might be a right to immunity from coercion. Suarez said even in Catholic countries we have to allow Jews and Muslims to carry out their worship in synagogues and mosques, provided they don't, you know, act directly against the church or cause trouble. But simply the fact of publicly carrying out worship of a non-Catholic religion, Suarez and much more later Emmanuel Kettler, who was one of the great advisors of Leo XIII in preparing Rerum Novarum. So there are currents, let's say, in traditional Catholicism, well before Vatican II, that at least hinted at the idea that you can have a right to immunity from coercion, even in public profession or worship of a non-Catholic religion, under some circumstances, certainly not always and everywhere. But then this question of circumstances needs to be taken account again, finally, in interpreting Vatican II. Vatican II's position is not so liberal as to deny that under certain past circumstances, the public manifestation of erroneous religious ideas and practices could have been, as such, a justly punishable threat to the common good of society. That is, it would jeopardize the rights of other citizens, public peace, or public morality. The factors mentioned by Vatican II. In short, the preconciliar and the conciliar doctrines, respectively, are not so absolute as to exclude and contradict each other. The perennial common thread in the Church's doctrine from ancient times up till now has been that, on the one hand, those persons outside the Church, especially those presumed to be invincibly ignorant of the truth of Catholicism, have a right to some degree of civil religious freedom. At the very least, of course, it's always been explicitly taught non-Christians can never be coerced into baptism and church membership, and should enjoy civil freedom to teach their religion privately to their own children. That at least, and much more sometimes. But on the other hand, the state also has the right to impose some limitations on the spread of harmful and dangerous ideas in the interest of the common good of society. So there are two poles here, positive and negative, that need to be kept in equilibrium: respect for erring consciences and the need to prevent the spread of the most dangerous propaganda. These limitations A, B, and C are very broadly defined in a way that leaves a lot of room for different interpretations as to what precisely those A, B, and C would imply under different historical circumstances. The difference between the old and the new has basically been a gradually changing emphasis in the Church's position. Traditionally, she emphasized more the negative end of the spectrum, the state's right to repress error. And from the mid-20th century onwards, she's been emphasizing more the human person's right to immunity from coercion. But changes of emphasis, however, even to the extent of making the rule what was once the exception, are not contradictions. What we have here, rather, are changing prudential judgments as to where to find the right balance between necessary freedom and just restraint. By the new prudential judgment implied in the Concilia Declaration, the Church gives more weight now than she did previously to subjective sincerity and the need to respect erring consciences in civil society, especially under the religiously pluralistic conditions that predominate in today's world. But a shift in emphasis is not a doctrinal contradiction. I think we can draw a parallel here with the Church's developing position on capital punishment. She continues to teach that this is not intrinsically, always and everywhere, unjust, but she now makes the prudential judgment that the death penalty can rarely, if ever, be justified under modern circumstances. That's in the Catechism number 2267, following John Paul in Evangelium Vitae. Similarly, Vatican II does not teach that it is or was intrinsically, always and everywhere, unjust for a Catholic state to repress all public manifestations of non-Catholic religions as being per se a danger to fundamental elements of the common good, which is what Vatican II means by just public order. But the Council does clearly imply, by what it says and what it significantly fails to say, the prudential judgment that under modern circumstances, such repression would, in any country on earth, violate the natural right to religious freedom of those concerned. The significance of the Council's failure to say that predominantly Catholic countries would be an exception to this rule is pretty obvious. When the highest church authorities in former times often urged the state repression of public non-Catholic religious activity as such, they certainly judged that the propagation of such errors constituted threats to at least one, and often all three, of the social values A, B, and C we have in our proposition P here. For the rights of other citizens, the spread of seductive religious errors among a Catholic populace, especially those with little education, was certainly regarded as a grave danger to their eternal salvation and thus a violation of their right to live in a Christian society that helped rather than hindered their battle against Satan and their pilgrimage towards heaven. Of course, still today, for a Catholic to lapse into heresy or apostasy is mortally sinful and results in the present code, as always, in automatic excommunication. Public morality. Sad experience in Western culture has shown repeatedly and with increasing clarity in recent decades that once the socially and legally recognized of the authority of the Catholic Church as the unique, authentic interpreter of the natural moral law is rejected as a result of anti-Catholic propaganda. In other words, once Christ the King is dethroned from society, public morality eventually takes a catastrophic plunge as well. We get legalized divorce, abortion, artificial procreation, euthanasia, unnatural birth control, so-called gay marriage, adoption rights for homosexual couples, and so on and so on. And those who promote these deviations, while denouncing the quote-unquote hate and bigotry of those who dare to voice disagreement, are now increasingly violating the right to religious freedom of traditional believers. So it's not only endangering public morality once you eliminate the Catholic Church from her social position as the authentic interpreter of the natural moral law. Not only does the moral law decline, but the right of those who believe in the true religion to publicly and privately manifest their beliefs is also threatened, as we see increasingly in states that have been bringing in so-called homosexual marriage. Finally, public peace. In many periods of history, the spread of heresy was very often a menace to the public peace. The same can be said today of those mosques and madrasas wherein Islamist imams preach the duty of armed jihad against the West. Heresy led to disastrous wars of religion, as we all know. Early Protestants were no more tolerant than Catholics were at that time and frequently persecuted the Church once they attained power by force of arms. So again, that violated not only public peace, but the right of Catholics to worship according to the true religion. Since Vatican II, given that religious pluralism is increasing the de facto reality throughout the world, The new norm of the Church's public law or policy in her relations with states is that not even in states with a Catholic majority may simple public dissent from Catholic doctrine without any aggravating factors be considered any longer a sufficiently serious threat to the common good as to warrant legal repression. But again, this is not a contradiction of previous doctrine. It's a new public policy of the Church, and as such, I think we can be entitled to question or disagree with it without dissenting from any doctrine. The Relator at Vatican II explained officially to the Fathers, just before they voted on the final draft of Dignitatis Humanae, that the requirements of the common good itself can change considerably over time. And he pointed out that this fact was relevant in addressing the concerns of some Fathers who said they did not want the Council to pass a sweepingly harsh judgment on the Church's own previous doctrine and practice. Bishop de Smet said, and I quote his words here, my translation from the Acta, "One should take into account the fact that human society itself has exhibited different modes of thinking and living in different ages." This is true, but and this is equivalently expressed when he affirmed that the norm for the care of religion is the common good. The common good, as everyone knows, is something relative. It is linked to the cultural evolution of peoples and has to be judged according to that development. Indeed, an appreciation of how changing historical conditions can reasonably and legitimately influence the formulation and practical application of Catholic doctrine is arguably the most important element in showing its essential diachronic continuity across the centuries in cases where this is not immediately apparent. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Father Harrison, for that very clear and careful exposition. And for the discussion now, I would invite Professor Thomas Pinkey to come and join us on the podium. So who would like to get the ball rolling? John Morris.
Okay. Father Harrison, you, at the outset, you from the premise that all the six ordered the inclusion of a clause stating that the Dignitatis Humanae leaves untouched traditional Catholic doctrine. You infer the conclusion that the mind of the Council Fathers in this doctrine was not to contradict the earlier teaching. But I'm not sure that this inference follows. So we know that Paul VI ordered the inclusion of this clause in order to satisfy the conservative minority of the council. We can know that he didn't himself believe it in an orthodox sense, because he later on openly contradicted this traditional Catholic doctrine by saying things like, All the church demands is freedom to preach the gospel. The church does not seek to use the world for her religious ends, etc., etc. So I don't see how you can draw the inference from Paul VI ordering this inclusion to the mind of the Council of Fathers being that, in an orthodox sense, there's no disagreement.
I wouldn't say that Paul VI contradicted in the comments you quoted. It has to be remembered he said, all in the closing speech of the council, all that the Church asked from you today, that word today, which you didn't mention, is there, is very important, because he's not saying necessarily that what the Church asks of you today is what the Church should have been asking and nothing more for the last 2,000 years. He was not laying that down as something which is that what the council is asking from governments today, namely just all we're insisting on under present circumstances is freedom and not privilege or special rights. He's not saying, Paul VI was not saying that that this is all the Church that the church has ever really been entitled to, and that we were wrong the previous 2,000 years for asking for more than that. I think that word today qualifies things very importantly. Also, I'm not simply deducing from Paul VI's insertion of those passages as the only reason I'm saying the fathers themselves didn't have the intention of contradicting Catholic doctrine. Remember at the beginning of my paper, I made the point, first of all, that as a general interpretive norm, you have to assume, unless it's otherwise made very clear, that there is no intention of an ecumenical council to contradict previous doctrine. And then there's also the fact that the Relata told the council fathers on more than one occasion that the doctrine that's being put before you in this scheme on religious freedom does not contradict previous doctrine. In other words, the assumption, I think, has to be that unless there's evidence to the contrary, particularly when the preamble itself, particularly the one about what we bring out from the treasures, old and new, but always in harmony with the Church's sacred tradition of doctrine, the fact that they were told repeatedly by the Relator that this is not to be understood as contradicting previous doctrine, I think the assumption has to be that, I mean, who knows, there was a wide range of opinion, of course, among the Council Father. They didn't all have the same view. But in general, I don't think you can say that there was any broad or widespread desire to contradict traditional Catholic doctrine. And I mentioned Paul VI, the fact that he impersonally ordered the insertion of those passages in the preamble and also in the final relatio. It just strengthened the fact that the Pope himself, who is the first signatory to the document, and the one who has the right to interpret it more authoritative than anyone else, was personally responsible for insisting on those. And of course, even if it was a minority of the fathers, they don't count even if it's only a minority of the fathers who didn't want to contradict traditional doctrine, I don't think that's the case for a moment. And even if the majority did want to contradict or had the intention of contradicting it, the intention of the Supreme Pontiff trumps that. I mean, none of the documents have any binding force at all, His Majesty, unless the Pope signed off on them. So, Don Bassi.
Someone wants to continue.
Sorry, go ahead.
A slightly new question.
Is that? Yes, it's about the same It's about the same question. I should like to add a couple of items about your question. First of all, we should remember that the Council of Fathers had been warned ahead of time that the draft would be remade according to Catholic traditional doctrine. So they were warned ahead of time in the previous session that would be done. It was a final relatio, a special relatio made by Bishop Desmet, saying, well, we have the task now to remake the draft according to Catholic traditional doctrine about the duties of men towards the true religion and the one Church of Christ. So they were warned about that. And although they had been warned about that, they voted with an incredible majority. They voted the document. And the second, so we have to say that an overwhelming majority of council fathers were agreeing to the fact that this had been added into the document. And the second point I wanted to underscore is that the footnotes of the document are official and they always refer to traditional Catholic doctrine in papal encyclicals, which have pointed out several times that the church had to be acknowledged by the state as the official religion. So that's the second thing they voted upon, and they voted positively, not negatively. So this is two items I just wanted to add in favor of what you
have. Also, Paul VI, in 1970, in an allocution to a meeting of Italian jurists, he made the statement that civil law should be conformed to the divine law, both natural and positive, which is basically a restatement of the kingship of divine positive law as revealed truth. Paul VI did say that that's the kind of the norm, regardless, proceeding for how practicable or feasible it was in modern secularized society. But he did say that in principle, civil law should reflect both the divine law, both natural and positive. I can give you the reference for that somewhere.
Father Brian, thank you for a really valuable and clear exposition of a very persuasive case for a reconciliation of the previous magisterium with that of Dignitas Humanae. Someone might have a discomfort, and it's to do with this. When you look at pre-conciliar teaching of Pius IX and Leo XIII, it looks as though they're not just endorsing a restriction of various public activities involving false religion in the public sphere to prevent violations of public order in an area where the civil power might naturally be thought to have an interest, whether or not it was a Catholic state. Things that are unclearly the responsibility of governments, like riots and things like that. It looks as though they're telling the Catholic state to restrict, at least in the public sphere, to a degree, spreading of religious error, precisely to protect the spiritual good of their subjects, to protect specifically religious truth for a religious end, the spiritual good of their subjects. All the rules would hold in honour the holy name of God. One of their chief duties must be favour religion, meaning the true religion, to protect it, to shield it, for the spiritual good of their subjects.
Yeah.
And then in Dignitas Humanae, you get this famous passage where it looks as though it's saying that state activity for the spiritual good of the subject, of the subjects, is somehow inappropriate. Furthermore, those private and public acts of religion by which people relate themselves to God in the sincerity of their hearts, of their nature, transcend the earthly and temporal levels of reality. So state direction, having said it should have a general concern, then says, with equal certainty the state exceeds the limits of its authority if it takes upon itself to direct or prevent religious activity. So it looks as though Dignitas Humanae is saying it's nefas, wrong, for the state, on the basis of a spiritual concern, to start restricting religious error. But it looks as though, before the Vatican Council, the state was supposed to have a concern for the spiritual good of their subjects and restrict religious error. Maybe this is actually consistent with your position. Could you say a little more about this?
Yes. Another one of the final amendments was in Dignitatis Humanae 3, in which, I wish I could find the actual quote here now. I've got it in my book here. But instead of laying down state neutrality as between religion and irreligion, which up to the second last draft, it seemed to be like that, there was another amendment saying that the state must favour the religious, recognise and favour the religious right, religious life of citizens. So it was, and it does say somewhere else that the state has to recognise the transcendent character of the human person. In other words, it is, let's say in the fine print, or not sort of so loud and clear, but it is saying that the state has to keep in mind the spiritual welfare of citizens as well as their merely temporal welfare. The earlier drafts didn't do that. The other thing is that I think that the quote you mentioned there, there was an objection from one of the conservative fathers to the very passage you quoted, and the response was given that this too has to be taken not as an absolute about the state goes beyond its power if it intervenes in prohibiting or requiring membership or profession of any particular religion. It says this too has to be taken in. It's assumed that the limits spelled out in number 7 apply to that statement as well, and we're not sort of repeating the limits every single time we mention things about religious freedom, but it's to be understood that these limits apply to that statement. So that statement is not to be taken as an absolute in an unlimited sense. And again, I think that that could also be one of the passages of Dignitatis Humanae that arguably are not being proposed strictly as doctrine, but as public policy for what the church should or should not do under modern circumstances.
Can I just press the point with an illustration from preconciliar theology? Again, I this is clearly going to be a very complex area. And take someone like Louis Chupin's book on the valeur des déclarations et décisions du Saint-Siège, which is a very central text, appearing in numerous editions either side of the First World War. When he's discussing what is regarded as theologically proved state behaviour in the sphere of religion, he makes a distinction between the state's restriction of religious activity as an act of what he calls repression of civil crime, from the state's regulation of or involvement in religious activity that's repression of specifically religious crime. And he says, the state may be repressing various religious activity simply because it's false, and rightly so, and then it's addressing it as a religious crime. Or it may be repressing it because there's a threat to public peace, or there's a threat to areas of morality that are not specifically religious, or to rights of citizens other than relation to religious truth. And then it's going to be repression of civil crime, and both are legitimate. And it looks as though Dignitatis Humanae is now saying, you've got to tell some story about civil crime, not religious crime, for it to be legitimate. So something's changed.
Well, number one, that's the opinion of a particular
approved
preconciliar theologian. But I'm making the point that you still have to distinguish between what's highly regarded or respected theology and what's actually part of the church's magisterium. And I don't know that the distinction that the author you quoted, I don't think that that's reflected in any of the, as such, the way you read it out then, in the encyclicals of Leo XIII.
Well, Leo XIII does make a very clear distinction between the state's duty, I mean, then you rhetorically, again, I think we'll have to look at texts greater care than we have time for now, between the state's duty to religious truth as religious truth, because the state has a duty to the spiritual good of its citizens, and then the state's duty to civilise its citizens, where religion will be a great help in all sorts of ways. Yeah. And so I think that distinction is floating around in the magisterium.
That's true, but as I said in the last part of my paper, you can understand this concern for the spiritual welfare of citizens. That certainly can be understood to come the rights of citizens, particularly those who are lesser educated, to live in a country, to live in a society where they're not faced with unnecessary temptations that go against their spiritual welfare. And so that can be seen as, and certainly would have been seen, the spread of false propaganda, particularly amongst the lesser educated people, as a violation of the rights of ordinary citizens not to be confronted with those sorts of temptations. So I don't see that this is ruled out by Dignitatis Humanae, except what it's implying as what should be the norm under modern circumstances, which certainly doesn't allow for the repression of religious error as such under modern circumstances. But even when it was approved as such, in other words, the repression of forced religious activity simply insofar as it's false, that still was in the interest of the common good, because the common good of citizens required that their spiritual welfare not be endangered by the spread of heresy. So it wasn't the teaching of the church at any stage that false doctrine can be repressed simply because it's false in a vacuum, or that is in without relation to the social context in which that false doctrine is going to affect the welfare of the people in the state. And all, just worth mentioning in passing that there is Dignitatis Humanae, another one of the final amendments to the final draft. It certainly does allow for the restriction of the worst forms of proselytism. You think of Jack Chick's vehemently viciously anti-Catholic comic books, and all kinds of unworthy, dishonest propaganda. It says specifically, this is another final amendment, this can be seen as a violation of the rights of citizens, particularly if they're not well-educated people.
Well,
I think Jamie had a hand up for a long time.
If we have Jamie first, and then follow Ezra secondly.
Jamie.
Sorry, go ahead. I take the point about public peace, and that could require, in certain circumstances, in the Catholic state, perhaps some time past, not today, suppressio veritatis corum. But is that really what the magisterium uses that phrase to mean? I mean, the magisterium said in the 19th century, using the phrase pax publica, tended to mean what we mean nowadays, at least what lawyers and states mean by public order. I fully appreciate that Vatican II's definition of public order is much wider than that. It's the whole point about A, B, and C. It would seem that that's what the magisterium historically meant. And if we're going to restrict ourselves to A, B, and C, which is after all the things that it does, how are we going to shoehorn into that the situation that you refer to in the past, where effectively merely preaching heresy, of course it depended how you did it, but in a way that served the consciences of the Catholics in the Catholic state, wants something that should be suppressed? Because on the face of it, unless you're going to read into the rubric of the rights of all citizens, something much wider than what is commonly considered by jurists, it doesn't appear to be to come under the rubric of public peace, unless of course the proselytizing heretics are preaching peace. And I'm not sure it's terribly convincing to say that it comes under the rubric of public morality, otherwise you're tending to confuse the difference between faith and morals. So in that sense, unless we're going to read it into A, either rights of all citizens to be free from being, as it were, harassed or taught heresy in the Catholic state, then on the face of it, Dignitatis Humanae does appear to signal a shift there, doesn't it?
Well, I think that certainly when it talks about the rights of other citizens, in application to the contemporary world, it certainly does not mean the right to repress false doctrine as such. As I've said, you know, it's very clear that they don't have that in mind for today. But keeping in mind the fact that the Declaration itself says in the beginning that this is to be understood in such a way that it's in harmony with and not in not in contradiction with the traditional teaching of the church, I think we have the right to say that rights of other citizens in Article 7 is sufficiently broad and open that it allows for what the relator said in the final thing about the common good changing over the centuries. The needs of the common good are not necessarily what they were hundreds of years ago in the society like Christendom. In other words, that we can understand this qualification about the rights of other citizens as including in previous societies when there was a consensus of Christendom, restrictions that would not be appropriate today or would not be considered to violate the rights of other citizens under contemporary pluralistic secularized society. So, yes, it's not very clear. I mean, I think the reason why we're having this colloquium is that for 50 years there's been obscurities and things that are not clear in this document, and this is one of them. But I think that we can, as you put it, squeeze that in under the rights of other citizens, at least for in application to former times, if not certainly not for what they had in mind for today. Father Basile, did you?
I just wanted to mention, I think you can also add public morality, because in certain circumstances and in some certain countries, it is part of public morality not to go against the faith. And public morality can decrease, and in our societies, then it is no longer against public morality, but it was in the former centuries.
But doesn't that blur the distinction between faith and morals?
But faith is part of morals.
Well, yeah, but historically, the church has always distinguished between the two.
No, because when you use the phrase faith and morals, you're talking about doctrine, what you should believe, and morals, what you should do. But what you should believe is one of the things you have to do.
Well, I mean, for example, if you were to deny a doctrine, a Marian doctrine, I mean, is that really a breach of public morality?
It is. In certain countries, it is. Because morality has not just to do with the sixth commandment, I mean, or a fifth commandment.
Well,
it also has to do with the first and the second and the third, and then so on. In certain circumstances, it has. And as Bishop Smith explained, this thing varies according to the countries and the periods and the different societies. Public morality is not the same. I mean, I was just replying to your...
Father Ezra, I think it's...
Yeah, my comment may... create more confusion. It seems to me that for even the proposition of a government condemning a religious error or a heresy as such requires the government to have a branch by which they will be able to recognize what counts as heresy or religious error. Now, in Catholic countries, this branch was called the Inquisition. And in fact, the Inquisition was the one that would condemn the religious error or the heresy per se, and it was the role of the government to condemn what was considered a civil crime. And so the Inquisition had the powers actually to jail and to punish and such, but these were always considered distinct because they said that the civil government does not have the competency to recognize religious error. Now what happens, I think Professor Rao's his exposition shows us that with Josephinism and so on, what starts to happen is that the government takes upon itself the ability to condemn what previously was under the competency of the church. And so now you have a state that is practicing both roles of church and state, and this is a problem.
That's Professor, you might like to comment. That's getting into your office.
I said no.
The traditional teaching of the church is certainly that the government, as such, the state, is competent to recognize which is the true religion. This is very clear in Leo XIII's Immortale Dei, that you know, God has giving clear signs of credibility that are suitable for all men, miracles, fulfillment of prophecies, and her stability and so on over the centuries. So the state is capable, just as human understanding, even before the gift of faith is given, is understanding, capable of understanding the what we call the motives of credibility of the Catholic Church. And certainly those princes, magistrates, civil authorities, they're human beings like everybody else, and the state is capable of recognizing which is the true religion, as deciding from that point onwards, yes, as you say, it's the Church's authority to decide what's heresy and what isn't. A particular historical form of that judgment was, of course, the Inquisition, well, the various different Inquisitions in different countries. But there's no reason why it would have to take that particular form. There's other ways in which the Church, simply the magisterium, the pontifical, or conciliar magisterium, declares certain propositions to be heretical or false or whatever, and in many or most cases it might be quite, you know, if someone's saying this in a particular country, it might not need any specific body set up other than just the Catholic bishops there to say, well, look, you know, this is clearly against the magisterial teaching of such and such encyclical or such and such an ecumenical council, and therefore the state, in the traditional public law and policy, would have the right to repress that.
Minister.
Would you agree, Father Harrison, that given your definition, your condensing of the doctrine of Dignitas Humanae, that in the light of the supernatural certitude of the virtue of faith, a formal heretic is never, by definition, acting in accordance with his conscience, and is therefore, by definition, not covered by the right to freedom from coercion in religious matters as laid out in the Council, as interpreted in New York?
Yes, that's a good point. The whole question of conscience and how to understand that word conscience, and who is in good conscience, who isn't, you know, that whole area, I just didn't have time to cover that in my talk. And but yes, when it comes to reconciling the teaching of the Council of Trent with Vatican II, I don't know whether, are you going to be saying something about that in your paper at all?
A little bit.
Yeah. But there is a canon of the Council of Trent, which is infallibly defined. If anyone says that those who were baptized in infancy, but on growing up, it's a bit vague whether it means sort of adolescence or young people, whatever, but when they shall have grown up, let's say, refuse to ratify their baptismal promises. If anyone say that people like that, baptized in infancy, but later they say, I'm giving up the faith, that they are not to be restrained or coerced to leading a Christian life by anything other than exclusion from the sacraments, anathema sit. Now, reconciling that Tridentine canon with Vatican II, I think, may well depend very much on this idea of conscience and the point that you've made, that the Fathers of Trent would by no means have conceded that the kind of people that they were saying could be coerced, baptized in infancy, then they're, when they get to be young men or women, they want to apostatize, they would have by no means conceded that these people were acting in good conscience. They're guilty of the sin of apostasy or heresy. And therefore, they can say, well, what Vatican II says, they're talking about people can't be restrained from acting in accordance with their conscience. Well, these people are certainly not acting in accordance with their conscience. They're guilty of one of the worst sins in the book.
It's at the back.
This is Father. I have a question, and it all depends on whether I understood you correctly. And if you're saying that Dignitas Humanae is a prudential application for our time of some principles which already existed and always have existed in the church's teaching. And if I understood that, that is what you're saying. Does that mean that these are going to be merely a prudential application? Does that mean they can be completely overturned? And taking into consideration what you have said about Catholic sort of morality completely disappearing from society whenever the church is no longer, the font, if you will, for what society should do, taking into consideration that that's always being the result, shouldn't then, in fact, isn't this prudential application in fact wrong? That's my question.
Yeah, I'm not saying that Dignitatis Humanae is nothing more than a different prudential application of the same doctrine that has always been taught. There is, I'd say, there are two things new in Dignitatis Humanae. There is a new development of doctrine as such, and also, I would say, new prudential judgments. The doctrinal development, I would say, strictly at the level of doctrine, which you find from Dignitatis Humanae 2 and maybe 3, particularly number 2, that's the key paragraph. It clarifies what was left really obscure, unresolved in the traditional magisterium, namely, whether or not there can be some circumstances in which a non-Catholic can have a right to immunity from coercion in publicly manifesting his or her non-Catholic religion. Now, as I mentioned in my talk, there were differences of opinion about this. Archbishop Lefebvre was of the view that, and I think the Society of the Pius X, this would be the consensus among most, or I know one friend, a priest in the society, who doesn't agree with Archbishop Lefebvre on this, but most of them certainly would, I think, that never under any circumstances can there be a right of the human person to be left free, in other words, be immune from coercion in the public manifestation of any false religion. Now, some, like Lefebvre, would agree with that. And let me just read you a little bit. If we've got time, I had a quote here from Suarez. I had a controversy with one of the Society of St. Pius X priests several years ago, in which I put to him, he was saying there can never be any right to immunity from coercion in public worship by non-Catholics. I said, now, if what you're saying, Father, is true, that means you would have to agree that when what's now Western Sahara was Spanish Sahara, under the control of Spain as a Spanish colony in the time of General Franco's regime, it's a 99.5 or 99.9% Muslim territory, but it was under Catholic sovereignty, the sovereignty of a Catholic state. So if what you're saying is correct, you would logically have to hold that no injustice would have been done had General Franco sent in the Spanish troops to close down every mosque in Spanish Sahara, because they're pagans, non-Christians, public worship. There could be no injustice in doing that, only perhaps imprudence. And the priest sort of evaded that question. He didn't really want to say them, but Suarez certainly wouldn't have held that. In fact, he said the following. I quote here from, I've got the book one of, don't have the reference here, but this is Suarez. As regards the religious practices of unbelievers which go contrary to Christian beliefs but not counter to natural reason, there is no doubt but that the unbelievers, even though they are subjects of a Catholic sovereign, may not be forced to abandon them. Rather, the Church must tolerate them. Well, that's always been undisputed. St. Gregory the Great addressed himself clearly to this problem regarding Jews, and he forbade anyone to deprive them of their synagogues or to prevent them from observing their religious practices therein. The reason is that such observances do not in themselves violate the natural law. Therefore, the temporal power of even a Christian ruler does not confer a right to prohibit them. Such prohibition would be based on the fact that what is being done goes contrary to the Christian faith. But that is not enough to compel those who are not subject to the spiritual authority of the church. This opinion is also supported by the fact that such a ban would involve, to some extent, forcing people to accept the faith, and that is never permitted. In other words, Suarez comes out very clearly saying that in certain circumstances, the government does not have any right to prohibit the public worship of certain non-Christians. And others like Archbishop Lefebvre said, well, no, they're not violating any rights of those people, but it would be imprudent and uncharitable in lots of circumstances to do that. So I would say that the genuine doctrinal development of Vatican II is to come down and resolve that question in favour of the side that Suarez was on there, that it is not true that there's never any circumstances in which a non-Catholic has a right to be left immune from coercion and publicly manifesting. In other words, there are some circumstances in which there is a natural right of the person to be left free from government interference in the public practice of his religion. So that's a doctrinal development, which I'd say is in harmony with tradition, because it wasn't explicitly taught by it, but it was a disputed question which has now been resolved. But then the other part of your question about prudential judgments, I would say that as well as this doctrinal development, you have the prudential judgment that under modern, pluralistic, global village-type circumstances, it would not under these circumstances be in accordance with the natural right to religious freedom to repress the public exercise of a false religion simply insofar as it is false, that this is no longer a sufficiently serious threat to the common good, even in predominantly Catholic countries, as to justify or warrant repression. I would say that is the new prudential judgment, and it's accompanied by this doctrinal clarification, which I would say is the main development of doctrine brought about by the declaration.
I know other people want to come in, but it would be good to take some breathing space before lunch. Of course, we'll be circling around these same questions for the next 2 days, and be a chance for everyone. So we have lunch at 1, we meet again at 2:30, and we thank Father Harrison again for his presentation.